shut up.
You need to put the gun.
You need to shut up.
You need to back off.
Sit down. I'm very sorry. I'm trying to get the landing right. You must understand. When you go in there. Come.
So I watched the beginning of Hot Tub Time Machine, and I couldn't keep watching it. It drove me nuts. Actually, it's funny, somebody brought that to the sink cabin and turned it on, but we didn't really check it out. But I watched it just because at the time I had a theory that John Cusack was being put into a deitized subliminal role repeatedly, and sure enough, at the beginning of the film, he's there marking packages that belong to his wife. He's like divorced or whatever, and he's like separating out things with little red stickers, and he puts one of them on the center of his forehead as a bindi. And I turned it off there because I was like, okay, there it is. I don't need to watch it.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, you also get, like, with John Cusack, you also get the cue, right?
Sure.
The cue of Kubrick, and then what else is interesting about, particularly about Hot Tub Time Machine, you'll notice everybody in the movie takes off their shirt except for him. I don't think I've ever seen John Cusack shirtless before. Even the chubby guy, even the chubby actor takes off his shirt into the time machine. But John Cusack wears a robe when he goes into the tub. He never...
What's his sister's name? Joan Cusack.
Joan. Yeah.
So they're both JCs. And they're the male and the female. It's like, and they're both Jesus. I love it. I found the Latin inscription, which is, it translates as, "Visit the interior parts of the earth. By rectification, thou shalt find the hidden stone." And it's across the top. So there's a grammatical value here. It's 726 equals 6. Times 11 to the second power equals 33 times 22. I don't know. I'd have to read this over to find out the significance of it. But the stone is a reference to, so, you know, Jesus is spoken of as the cornerstone. So he's the cornerstone that the builders rejected in the New Testament. But then in the Old Testament, that is a reference to the Shekinah. When you say the keystone shall be the head of the archway. And so that's the stone that they reject. So they reject the ultimate receptivity and put it in its place, just the blind will, right?
So, interesting. And the association of Shekinah with the female, and the idea of, this also fits with my moon theory, basically, which puts Friday as the first day of the week, essentially. So putting the woman first, which is the concept. The concept of receptivity. And it, so that when you're going under an archway, you are entering into a cosmic vagina, basically, with the keystone at the top, right?
Yeah. You want to hear what he has to say about this hidden stone? Is also called the universal medicine. It is sometimes described as a stone, sometimes as a powder, sometimes as a tincture. It divides, again, into two forms, the gold and the silver, the red and the white, but its essence is always the same, and its nature is not to be understood except by experience. It is because the alchemists were dealing with substances on the borderline of matter, quote-unquote, that they are also so difficult to understand. The subject matter of chemistry and physics in modern times is what they would have called the study of dead things. For the real difference between living things and dead is, in the first instance, their behavior. Now, this is the significance of what Crowley brought to the tarot. Is he considered the most important card of the tarot, in his opinion, to be the Ace of Discs, which he put 666 in the center of, which is the sun, expressing that everything comes from, so every man and woman is a star, is an extension of every man and woman is the sun, basically, because all, not to be too crystal hippie, but we're all stardust, right?
Right. No. That makes sense.
This idea, we all come from one living thing, and so you can't look at matter as dead and spirit as alive, because the spirit is so intimately tied with the material that there's a contrast, but there's a distinction, but there's no separation.
Okay, well, this is interesting to me, this idea that we so we would be emerging from the sun, but then we would have to be cycled back in towards it, right? Because go ahead.
There's your torus. Just saying.
Right, right. No, yes, that makes sense because that's your toroid shape, right? So your donut shape, you go around the outside of the sphere and then back in through the same hole that you apparently came out of.
Really?
Right? Yeah, so, well, no, if you see it as the donut hole, right, you're going, if you're emerging from the donut hole, you travel along the surface of the donut, and inevitably you go back in the same hole you came out of, basically. And then you see appear to be, but you're not really going in or out of anything, essentially. And what I'm wondering is, what I wonder about this model is, does it represent a passage of the human soul continually into the sun to then be regurgitated outward only to a certain point to then be sucked back in? That's first part of my question. And the second part is it possible to travel in the other direction, right? So instead of moving towards the sun, you're moving away from the sun and out of the solar system So that's the question. Is the solar system the system of systems?
Okay.
Or is it possible? Go ahead.
I have to drop this on you. I'm really excited over what you're saying. I hate to interrupt, but...
No, that's okay.
You guys got my link I put up earlier to my photo of the Jodorowsky thing. It's in our messages.
Yeah, I'm checking it right now.
So you can see the way that the cards were arranged is in the swastika, but the swastika was represented in two directions. Hitler thought he was being clever when he reversed it from the direction he saw because he wanted to represent it as evolution. So you had involution and evolution, not realizing that had been done, many times before. But this is exactly, seems to me, what you're expressing. When you have evolution, you have a moving away from the sun. That's why this thing is a solar symbol. This is a solar disk, right? To express that the Marseille was originally, according to Jodorowsky, intended to be this solar symbol is very suggestive because here you have every... archetypal possibility of reshaping of forms. So if a form breaks down, it gets reprocessed and reinstituted. This is expressing the wheel of evolution, but just as easily it can be turned in the opposite direction to represent involution, which is just what you're talking about as far as I can tell. This is why in commentary on Patanjali, it's expressed that yoga is against nature. And I think that this is really misunderstood by people, and this is also something in the church that was misunderstood to be against nature, and this is why there's a lot of self-abuse and...
Sure. That makes a great deal of sense, because yoga, the idea of... And because yoga meaning union, right? And so therefore, and this fits in very nicely, I think, with P.K. Dick's idea of the so-called black iron prison, right? It's like if it's a system that leads us towards the sun and then back out only to a certain point, that represents union, right? It's an actual, and of course, yoga is highly solar. Would you not agree with that?
Oh, I agree, yeah.
Yeah, so there you have it, basically. So that's interesting. So would you say then that, I'm looking at the picture of the Jodorowsky thing right now. So it would just be a matter of taking the flags and flipping them to the other side to get it moving in the other direction, I guess.
Yeah, it's that idea. Yeah, it could go either way ultimately. Although he doesn't say that, that's what you can assess. That it's expressing learning the dynamics of the vacuum, and it's like the only way beyond material existence is directly through and not around, and that's
right.
That's,
yeah.
Like, people try and get around that any way they can. Because who wants to have to face birth, growth, decay, and death as a means of liberation?
Yeah.
If you get liberated, usually it's an escapist ambition. This is explaining that, no, you have to, and that's why sorrow is emphasized, and that's why the Shekinah is the stone that the builders reject, is because people don't want to experience empathy, real empathy. To actually feel connected to those around you means to experience empathy. And to experience that is to experience pain. And who wants to experience fucking pain?
Right. So I get it. So depending upon how you look at it, okay. So then according to the Kabbalistic or basically the Jewish tradition, and that makes sense, this recycling this through this torus is how we learn to experience empathy, which is inherently against nature, basically.
Right, it's against our nature to, like, the ego structure, this is not what it says in the Kabbalistic schools necessarily, but this is what I extrapolate from what I've looked at, to build up an ego structure or a sense of self on that regard, other than just I am-ness, the feeling of I am, but everything we put on top of that feeling, our reference points that connect us to everything else through a conceptual means, that is, like, basically what stands between us and this actual liberation.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. So then it would be our own will that draws us back into the solar wheel, basically, because of the need to continually justify our self.
But at the same time, this isn't as much of you say it's our will, but it's also something that's there in the midst, whether it's just we don't realize it.
Right.
So that's why revelation just simply means to unveil, right?
To reveal it, yeah. Of course, yeah, okay, yeah, very interesting.
To see the thing, because if we have a wall of representational models of things in between us and the things we're actually interacting with. So when you're interacting with a person, and you have a conceptual wall between you and them that's like it's also a power structure because it's built as a coping mechanism in order, because of birth trauma and all the trauma that followed in our trying to find our place in this experience of being alive, you know,
right.
This thing that's held together through like psychological glue or whatever, you know, it's like it's and everyone's affirming it, so it gives it more reality.
Very interesting.
Is this sort of connected to the idea of the difference between healing and curing? So, like, cancer is a possibility within the human universe, but to have a medical structure that says, got cancer, don't worry, we'll cut it out or we'll blast the shit out of it with radiation.
Right.
Like, that is the wrong way to go, because that takes responsibility out of your hands and you can just be cured instantly. Whereas
sure.
Healing would say, you know, you need to prevent cancer as best as possible through, you know, exercise, diet, sexual health, along down the line. That it's you need to take ownership of your physical universe and maintain it to prevent cancer. And you might even have cancer, but it might not cause any problems within that kind of flowing, being in balance with all the things that you have at your disposal.
Right. Well, you can enter into remission through various means, and the people who have presented that, I mean, there's plenty of evidence that they were fucked with in a major way, because cancer is a huge business. This is another subject, but the pharmaceutical companies do not want cancer to be cured, and they'll stop at nothing to make sure that that doesn't happen. What they want is putting things off. They don't want complete remission. That's not a helpful thing for them.
But maybe this is the angle I take upon that, Dave, is that maybe you go into something like that blindly, thinking you're doing a good thing. You build this whole medical complex, right? When then you realize that there's a different way, a better way, the beast is so big that you have to be very careful with how you disconnect it. You can't just disconnect the whole cancer industry, because the whole system will fall. It'll collapse. So how do you – it's like the whole
But isn't that kind of a trap, Bill? I mean, doesn't it just sort of leave you saying, well, I can never change this system because I can't give myself the power to dismantle it?
Well, because then it becomes the whole thing in itself, is that you can't cure the world of the cancer industry. You just can't cut it out, because it's grafted itself into the living dynamics of the whole system. So now you have to heal the world of the cancer system. You need to erode it slowly. You discover the way to do the thing itself, and then you need to apply it to the disease itself. Your horror is that, holy shit, we've gone down the wrong path, but you can't just jump to the left. You have to be like Danny. You need to take careful steps backwards to reverse the process itself. So it would be like the whole McDonald's argument. You realize that McDonald's serves poison in, 10,000 restaurants around the world, but you can't just stop serving poison because so many different industries have long-term contracts and employ millions of people working towards that system.
If McDonald's suddenly stopped working, then it would be catastrophic to our system. It would be like the Titanic hitting an iceberg.
Yeah, you can't just cut off the tumor that's attached to the body of the economy. You need to find a way to slowly regress it and slowly kind of heal the system. But, why make that explicit to people who just won't understand it? That to me might be what the great problem is right now in the world, is that there are people who have this awareness of it, they're in control, but now they have to find a way to get everyone on board to sort of heal the system. And they might realize it might take, 150 years and four generations of people. But you have to deal with the sort of big bulging tumor, and there's just this confusion as what to do with it. I don't know.
Well, that's it. No. I mean, just on my own, because listening to you talk about this, Bill, the two words that jump out at me are heal and cure, as if there's a difference between the two, and that's sort of what you're proposing.
Healing speaks to holistic, and cure speaks to cutting, I would say.
But here's go ahead, David. You have a thought?
No, it's just that the cancer in the first place is an attempt to heal. I mean, it's a natural process that's trying to make something right. It doesn't know what else to do.
Well, it's a wake-up call. It's a natural alarm. When cancer started happening so often, it said, hey, we might want to consider smoking two packs of cigarettes, eating bacon and eggs and butter and sausage and drinking, 2 gallons of liquor every day is whether or not that's good for us in all spectrums.
Jeez, sounds good to me.
Compensation, right? So the universe compensates. So if you've gone so far in one direction, it does its best to to make things right. And so cancer.
And apparently, because things go on, I guess it does so successfully, right? That's something else that I would say about it is that even the existence of anything at all is so wildly unlikely that there appears to be some kind of stability to the system.
Well, basically, why are we so goddamn arrogant and ignorant to not realize that we'll accept radiation and chemotherapy on our own body when everyone knows chemotherapy for the Earth is just fucking the wrong way to go? Individual life, so yeah, give me radiation chemotherapy. But they might protest the use of radiation chemotherapy in their backyard. It's to equate those two and kind of get the message.
Well, I think, if you're wondering why we're so appear to be so arrogant in regards to our ability to take things into our own hands, and this is kind of what I was going to say, but Freud talked about the death drive, right? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe, and I don't mean to oversimplify what Freud was talking about, because I know that anybody who's an expert on Freud will say that
if we talk about Freud at all, we're going to do that. I don't care how much an expert on Freud you are. That's just what happened.
Okay, all right. You're dead. I won't disagree with that. So we can just put that whole idea aside then. And just this idea of the death drive being the conscious, that there's an underlying desire to just not exist, basically, because existence carries with it so many, in the Shakespearean slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And it seems to do so for most of the people some of the time, and all of the people or many of the people all the time. So you have that idea being there. Could it be that the attempt to make a cure is fundamentally murderous, essentially? And I mean, as somebody who spent a lot of time in the health system, because I've had many serious injuries, and then I'll leave it at that. I've often got this, the feeling of the murderousness of medical treatment, basically, and the way in which patients are treated, and just the idea of being a patient You know, the time when you have to wait the most is when you're in need the longest, or in need the most, basically. So, you know, you're sitting there in agony and you have to wait for 12 hours to see a doctor, which is the case in a lot of places here. So you have this idea of the death drive being associated with the cure, right? Mm-hmm. This is what I'm just, because this just popped into my head. I love word games, right? And I'm particularly fond of, like, you know, Kabbalistic and Gematria type of word games. And if you take cure, you can, I would just take the letters QR, like QR, right? And that gives you kof or kuf and resh, which means the head and the back of the head. So right, it seems right.
The sun and the moon.
Yes. So you have the cure then resonating from the concept of the head, basically. But if you take heal, you have hey, and you have al, basically, or the seed of God, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be to heal then must come from some kind of greater cosmic source. It's something that
window of God.
Window, yes, yeah, a window to God as well, yeah.
Sure.
So in other words, that light coming down. Oh, and that's interesting, because so therefore, when you go into a church with its beautiful stained glass windows, when that light comes down, that light would be heal. It would be hail.
Right. In that case, you'd make a better hay than a Dalit.
Yeah, exactly.
You'd make a better
window
than a door.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's interesting, too, because I really like that, because that gets into the idea of the actual predicament of being God, if there is a unitary single God, right?
Yeah. If you want to jump back and forth between the English and the Hebrew like this, you could actually make the argument that window and door, hay and Dalit equal head.
Oh, interesting. So wow, beautiful. Beautiful. I love it. Beautiful. That's fantastic. No, that's beautiful. Shit. So that takes me right back full circle. So I thought I was onto something, and you laid the trump card perfectly. Well, so we're stuck with it, it appears.
Huh.
Round and round in the circle game, as the poetess says.
Wasn't that fucking... never mind. I'm trying.
No, please,
Circle? I was trying to remember which folk singer did the circle game. I thought it was...
Joni Mitchell.
Joni Mitchell, okay. Yeah, there we go. Which is really beautiful, by the way. I didn't realize how awesome Joni Mitchell was until just a couple years ago.
That girl is serious talent, boy.
Yep.
I think about to muse about Joni Mitchell, because I'm a huge, huge fan of hers. I have been since I was in high school. And I just, her, as a composer of songs, as a singer, and as a realizer of music, I mean, she pretty much is at the absolute pinnacle as far as I'm concerned. And you know, whenever I'm accused of being a misogynist, I just pull out Joni Mitchell. And I'm frequently accused of being a misogynist, but I can say that I put Joni Mitchell right at the top of pop music.
Because you give a lot of massages? Is that how that works?
I like that. If I ever had a chance, I'd use that one. I don't get out much, though, so I'll be 70. Hey, I'm a misogynist. Would you like a massage? Yeah. Oh, boy.
The medium is the misogynist.
That's good. Oh, I love it. Yeah. Mass age. So the mass age of the massage is the misogyo. So the one, interesting. That one's going to kick around in there for a while now.
Before we started, we were talking for about 10, 15 minutes before you joined us, Dave, and we were thinking about if it's possible to make a movie, or if there is a movie out there that just simply doesn't sync with anything. Like the most unsync movie that one could recommend to somebody. But that it's impossible, right?
Well, it's a theoretical. When we were talking about this, Bill, I was going to get to the idea of the Kinsey. You know, Alfred Kinsey, the guy who wrote the famous sexual report. He was actually a biologist. And his real hobby was studying the gall wasp. And, you know, he actually had over a million samples of gall wasps, and no two were alike, essentially. And so this idea of the original experience, or the unsync experience, would have to be completely mythological. It couldn't ever be found, right? And that's the whole point about that Robert Anton Wilson is making with the so-called patapsychology. I mean, of looking for the thing, the one thing that is actually normal or singular or unique. And if you think of this, and I've been staring at this Tarot wheel of Jodorowsky's, like literally since you mentioned it the second time, David, and it just blows me away. At the center of sink, the one place where things are not sinking, it's the eye of the hurricane, right? It's where nothing is happening. Theoretically, nothing is happening there. So mm-hmm. what that means is that the instant that anything tries to, and this is where I get an idea, a sense of the true concept of what it means to be immortal, right? Because the only true death could be nothingness. I mean, human beings, we exist as abstract principles and as concrete beings of a physical dimension. We have a material aspect and we have an abstract aspect. And neither of those two aspects can enter into nothingness, essentially. Mm-hmm. So whatever it is that we are somehow remains intact. And I mean, it even has to be somehow wholly intact. Like the concept of a dissolution after death, I think, is a myth, because the abstract principle of a human being cannot be divided down into any particular kind of thing. Like, what am I? That question is not answerable, mm-hmm. right? So therefore, the unanswered question comes flying out of that single sinkless point at the center of everything.
Sure.
Just as it went in, exactly as it went in.
Well, you know, what crosses at the center here is you can see the world there, but beneath it is the fool. And so he makes the fool and the world into a cross.
Yes.
And that is essentially canceling out. So when you have these two sides of the continuum, the two cancel out and create an equilibrium, which is what you're speaking to. And so that's the argument that I would say for a film being, if you could come up with a film that couldn't possibly sink, it would be the one that sinked so much that everything canceled out, right?
Oh, yeah, okay.
You go so far in the extreme direction that you come out the other side, basically.
The thing that's perfect, what was the thing from Futurama that you
It says, you know, if you do something perfect, people won't be sure you've done anything at all.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So, and that's totally. that law of compensation. That's why it can appear to people that there is no magic, is because there's just so much.
I do agree with that. But in that same, I completely agree with that. I have this, you know, as I've mentioned in our conversation so far, just this concept that the mere existence of anything at all makes every single thing that we see or do in some way miraculous. But, well, not in some way. It makes it completely miraculous. I mean, I won't pull my punches on that. Everything that's happening is an outright miracle all the time. And yet, because it is an outright miracle, doesn't that normalize it? Doesn't that just mean that it kind of just means nothing anyway? I mean, that's the existential torment, and that's the Kierkegaardian torment that I live in, basically, myself.
That was the idea when you go deep into A Course in Miracles, which I, you know, I don't believe is a helpful thing to recommend to anybody unless if they were raised with super heavy Christian propaganda and conditioning and programming, you know.
Right.
But if you have been raised in such a scenario, I would highly recommend the course, because it uses the same language in order to basically reconcile a lot of the inherent, dangerous beliefs that can mold perceptions and make things very fear-based.
Is that a course that you took? Because I know
I didn't do the workbook side of it, but I read the text of A Course in Miracles a good 5 or 6 times.
I just bought that book. I got it in the mail about 3 weeks ago.
Really?
And it seemed like one of those anomalous things that I've always heard about, and I needed to kind of put my nose into it and just check it out. And I opened it up and I looked at the first page and I just put it back on the shelf because I just knew I couldn't get into that right
what
now.
What was it? What was the book?
A Course in Miracles. But the first part of it is it's nothing real can be threatened and nothing unreal exists.
Yeah.
And says if you really, really, really get that, you don't have to read another page.
David?
I just saved myself $40.
No, seriously. I mean, to a certain extent, Dave, that's kind of exactly what I did, was that I read that, and then there was just, I just was like, okay, you just saved me.
Right, but the thing is that for people who are very, like, have layers of really intense, you know, conditioning in that area, you need that wake up again and again and again. Nothing to really, you can meditate on that for eternity, that nothing real can be threatened. So if you have nothing real can be threatened, you have absolutely nothing to fear. And because there's so much fear involved in the way that Christianity gets presented, it's just a call.
Yes, very interesting.
Well, that to me is sort of like the transition of spending too much time in the cube and then stepping outside into the sphere, and you just kind of go, what the fuck was that all about back in that cube of mine? You know, it resolves itself immediately once out into the sphere of nature for me. You know, it just, it can stop that racing train of thought or those kind of spiraling microcosms of anxiety that I might fall into, which are entertaining, and it's nice to be able to do that, but you need to find a way to put an end to it. And so that's sort of the direction which I come, I approach that nowadays.
But it's very much, I think it can be seen as a kind of a climax-inducing event too. Like, because if you go, if you start telling yourself something like nothing can be real can be threatened, for me, it was that exact, this is extraordinary. Because when I had my so-called epiphany, or whatever you want to call it, I mean, even thinking about it these days is something I hardly ever do. And I don't generally talk about it because it's embarrassing. Like, I fell apart in a sense. Well, not in a sense. I mean, I really did fall apart. But it was this very idea that nothing that occurred to me, basically, somehow, that nothing that was real could be threatened, that led me to do some very, very dangerous things. And I can see that as kind of a climax now. This Course in Miracles would actually be necessary, like you're saying, David, to take people down from this incredibly precarious place of their belief in their own spiritual power, maybe. Does that make sense?
Right. And how that itself can become a like a coping strategy to not have to deal with the realities of existence.
Oh, yes. That's very, so very interesting.
Yeah, it's like the smoke screen or whatever. And so, yeah, no, I recommend it to people. When I was in the desert in Arizona for a few months, staying on a property with a bunch of women who were in their 80s who had built mud huts. They're all living in mud huts. And there was a woman there that went to she taught at Berkeley, and she was very close with the woman who channeled A Course in Miracles. And she basically expressed, without any question, that this woman did not know where the fuck that came from. It came out of her, and she wrote it down, and there was a man working with her. But then what's interesting is I find after the fact, I think this would be easy for people to pull out the jump to conclusions board with, but that the man who she worked for actually had connections with MK Ultra, that was helping her put the book together. Even though she was channeling it and didn't know where the fuck it was coming from and was the one, spewing it out, he had these ties. But it should be understood that MK Ultra had so many subsections, and so, like, it was a very vast thing. It was not a, just what you read about MK Ultra doesn't apply to every facet of MK Ultra. But it is interesting nonetheless. So they had a huge just psychology department that went on and on, and they did, I mean, some good things came out of MK Ultra too. I'd probably piss some people off with that statement, but those people probably haven't done too much actual research into it. You know, I mean, not everybody involved with that had the worst intentions. I mean, we wouldn't have LSD flood America if it wasn't for MK Ultra. To anywhere near the degree that it did.
Well, actually, your description of that fits very, very much fits in with the idea of the Matrix too, the movies, because, you know, they say we sometimes have to do these things because we're fighting to free everyone, basically, right?
So I've connected the Course with the Matrix more than anything else. I've connected with the Matrix. very, it seems rather inspired, like The Matrix was inspired by the chorus. It's a feeling that I get. I heard a whole thing.
There is something about it that's world shaking.
So I had a friend about 10 years ago that had gone through this schooling that he said was a school that came out by the Wachowski brothers. That the Wachowski brothers, before they came out with The Matrix, had a whole school that it charged a lot of money. That might be beside the point, but for people to get over core issues, and that their slogan was that there's nothing in the water. And I wish I could remember what this was called. I bet I could look it up, but I know for certain that it's true because my friend and his girlfriend had gone through the process together, and they said that they were not allowed to tell me what it was that they taught them there. But it was actually the Wachowski brothers have an organization, and he said that they have these hallways and they have water coolers down the hallways more than they should. Like every other door had a water cooler, and because their slogan is "there's nothing in the water," there's nothing in the water. It would trip everyone out because they thought that there was something in the water. But this is a real thing, and it was kind of interesting. Like, and he said, sure enough, yeah, he had major issues. My friend Yoshi had major issues with his mother, and it was actually this school changed his whole perception of everything. I was really like kind of blown away by his that part of his description, even though he refused to go into any kind of real detail.
Where was the school? Like, what part of the United States?
I don't know. I think it may have been in California because he was in California, but I'm not sure of that.
Because it's weird because I lived in Rogers Park, where the Wachowskis are from, right around the time that they probably picked up and left Rogers Park. That I don't know what that even means, but, you know, kind of sinky for me.
And they're around their age too, right? They're both in their mid-30s around right now, or late 30s?
Oh, no, they're got to be mid-40s.
Oh, okay. I'm bad with that kind of thing. All right. So they're my age then.
I would assume because, you know, that movie Bound, I think, was from like 96.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But I was pretty sure that they were both in their very early 20s when they made that movie. Not that it matters. I'm just a curiosity.
What happened to that, Alfred? How'd you know about
they're in their late 40s, it looks like.
All right.
Sorry.
I'm glad we cleared that up.
I are Huckabees, and there's the part where the guy says he's curious or whatever, or he's being too curious, and the guy goes, "What happened to your cat?" And he goes, "How'd you know about my cat?" And he goes, "Curiosity killed the cat." Cat when he was growing up, but I don't know. I found that we talked about it last week, but I Heart Huckabees is extremely sinky, and tying back to the odd strength, Tet, the ninth gate thing, I found it really interesting that they emphasize with the teacher that comes in who's all about meaninglessness, that she
yes.
The force, and he goes, the force? And she goes, no, the force, it's French for strength. And so here you have the Major Arcana introduced in this way, which becomes extremely applicable in her role in the plot line of what happened with the way that Crowley reinstituted that card.
Very interesting. That makes a great deal of sense to me because when I saw the film and they identify the actress Isabelle Huppert, who plays the nihilist teacher, or the nihilist, as they say in the film.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There's a scene where she has sex with the Jason Schwartzman character, and they're both literally in the mud having sex. And this, to me, connected with the idea from Crowley, where he said he wanted to create a creature out of slime, basically, through an act of anal copulation.
Right.
To give birth to a creature of swine. Of slime, basically. So when I saw that film, the first time I heard Huckabees, I thought to myself, oh, they're saying that that's what they're doing. These two are having anal sex, basically, in that scene where they're romping around in the mud, essentially. So I think that's the Crowley divergence right there.
They're getting it all in the back. You're saying somethingness, nothingness, over and over again.
Right. Well, that, yeah, I mean, well, yeah, sure. But I mean, what I'm trying to connect right here is this idea of how in I Heart Huckabees, I think these characters are engaging in anal copulation, because this is the thing with Crowley, and this gets back to the idea of the ego and the will, right? The idea of breaking the cycle, right? So you're no longer returning through Venus, which would be the vagina, towards the sun. Instead, you're crashing through the gates of Mars, and you're turning the... Oh, that's interesting, too. There's a... Have you guys seen the film called Crowley?
I have.
I love the movie myself. I thought it was hilarious.
Well, it's pretty funny.
I thought it was very, very funny. It's actually really, really clever. It's worth taking a look at. And there's a scene in the movie where he appears to be screwing a guy in the eye, basically.
Oh.
Right? There's a scene where he uses a needle and he injects a guy right into his eyeball. But the way the scene is set up in this film about Crowley, it's set up like a phallus going into the eyeball. And this is the way I see Jupiter, right, as an eyeball. So maybe this is just a suggestion here. Well, what I'm saying is that Crowley is aiming past Saturn or outside of Saturn towards, in quotations, Uranus, basically. So, and this is the idea of breaking the cycle of time, right? Because it is beyond, in the planetary sense, it is beyond Uranus that we go into the underworld and into Hades or Pluto. Or
do you know about the Gnostic sect, the Mandeans?
Yes, yeah.
And that they were of that... weren't they of a end of the world type of bent, and mm-hmm. that I don't think that they were into procreation.
No, they weren't. They rejected it, basically. In right. It was almost Buddhistic in that sense.
And so, any which way, but you know, vaginal
intercourse.
Well,
no, there you have it. Yeah. So yeah. I mean, it's a touchy subject, obviously.
And that their only means of employment was silversmithing?
Oh, that is interesting.
Am I getting that correctly?
I don't know, but I don't know that. I have not read that myself.
So they would just, I mean, it was just such a reductive kind of lifestyle that it was just kind of built to go out of business, in a sense. But I mean, that to me is sort of, like, the whole thing is that if you think the world is headed for apocalypse, then why would you procreate?
Right. Well, that's...
So, which means, well, to me, is that basically you're, to accurately understand that, is that the world isn't headed for apocalypse. You yourself are headed for apocalypse. And that this is sort of the breaking open the head and the emergence of starting from zero, where you're going to throw yourself into this reformative chaos and darkness and storm and stress. And why would you subject some new human baby into your maelstrom? Why would you imprint them with your madness? So that's how I read it from my own seemingly through having the luxury of perspective on that line of thinking.
Right. Well, you having a child is an attempt to create immortality on the level of form, right? So you pass the name on. But the name is a concept. The representation is a concept. And so it's a simultaneous eversion to immortality, right? Because to be immortal would be to recognize your immortal essence and to turn away from that intense desire to continue on simply on this level of manifestation, right? I guess that would be the idea there.
Yeah.
See, and that's where I kind of start to break, and I start to wonder if that's even possible. Basically, that it's just, and in my opinion, at this time, the idea of a higher level of consciousness is something that literally drives the toroid over the top, essentially. In your article, David, from the Sync book, you talk about how the two triangles on Dark Side of the Moon turn into a Shield of David, right, or a six-pointed star.
Sure.
Well, I see, now if you take Christ as the seed of David, right, This is what it, how
even though he denies that in the gospel completely.
Yes, yes. Well, there. That's because of the intervention of the angel that impregnated Mary, right?
Well, like, yeah.
Because, I mean, because, no. If you follow in the book of Matthew, there's a lineage that goes all the way from Abraham right up to Joseph.
Sure.
So they are actually connected. Joseph, the carpenter, the cuckold father, is actually of the David clan, right? So in a sense, Christ supposedly adopts this clan as his way of entering the world. But you have this Star of David. So if you take that as the 666, right, the Star of David, because you have 6 points, 6 triangles, and then the interior hexagon making a 666.
Sure, so and the tree itself.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Tree itself is the unfolded star.
Exactly,
which I go
yes.
into in that article too.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. Yeah, exactly. It just unfolds into an exterior hexagon, basically.
Right. So go on.
With the one, yeah, no, yeah. But so what I propose is that this star is actually like, it's the single cog at the center of the toroid that continues to push experience upwards towards the upper curve of the toroid shape before the so-called apocalypse that happens when you start to fall down towards the horizon. Basically.
Okay. Yep.
So that's how I see it. So this 6-pointed star in the center actually rotates. Like,
well, okay, so that's where that's tricky, because the Aught is represented as the 6 directions as well. And so this is the question of Matat or Metatron. So when you have this the representational knowledge that is not the actual knowledge but is like a placeholder, which is the crown of thorns. You could take that you can go in different directions with the 6 directions. You could say that the 6 directions are actually what's breaking apart the tree, or you could say that the tree itself needs to be reconciled into the ultimate 6 directions. So it becomes like more of like an Alice in Wonderland kind of like.
Sure, but it would be. That's exactly how it would be, because when any experience or when any form of reality, material or otherwise, is moving along the curve of the toroid away from the center towards the top edge of the donut, basically, that would be the tree fundamentally coming together or growing, all right? And then at the top, it becomes the seed, and right?
Right.
At the end of its cycle.
It can't get around its dynamics. It has to look for compensation. So in order to reshape it, you have to follow there's no way around the dynamics. All you can do is pull the dynamics apart, but they'll still do what they do. And
yes,
so
exactly. That's right. I agree completely. So that's what happens at the top of the tree, which would be the top edge of the toroid, is that the dynamic begins to break down. It breaks down into its smallest essence, which is the seed, and it falls back into the waters of creation, where it's pulled even further down to the very bottom and then back up towards the center again. And at that center in life would be the crucifixion of the individual himself as an immortal human being. That would be the truly Gnostic experience, where one gets hung up, you might say. And the reason that I brought this up is because of this idea of a higher plane, I think, is nothing more than the mechanism as it draws us up past the Gnostic experience and towards the top of the donut again, basically, before we take another fall, essentially. So it's just the way I see it. It's like if you're truly seeing the system as holistic, then all the ascendant experience really is just exactly the counterpart of yet another falling experience. It's like an eternal bungee cord or something like that.
Sure. I think the Fountain by Damon Aronofsky represents it perfectly when you look at the in the past as a conquistador.
Love that movie.
Where he gets, basically, he eats of the tree and he becomes one with the material expression in the dense side of form. And then simultaneously, where you have him going to more etheric levels to reach the singularity that's transcendent even of itself, breaks everything down in the sphere. So you have on one side, he's becoming one with Malkut. And on the other side, he's becoming one with Keter. And the two actually meet, and there he is in the middle with the seed of life.
Mm.
Just
yes,
reconciling
beautiful.
The death of his wife, which
absolutely beautiful. That's beautiful.
He has to reconcile his own death, which is expressed in this internal process. And so there you have both sides of the tree going in their different directions, but the reconciliation actually happens at Tiferet, which is where he is, which is on a heart level to do with his relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there a huge controversy surrounding the release of that movie, or wasn't there... Yeah.
Kind of. Not that huge, but huge in the sense that they didn't know if it would market. They didn't know how to market it, and they didn't know, because it was just so, it was like, what is this?
I love the film myself. And I compared it strongly to 2001. The scene, at the very final scene of the film, or not the very final scene, but near the end of the movie, when he is ascending inside the sphere, and he's the tree of life that is representing his body is reaching its point of ultimate decay. At that point, his wife, also as Queen Isabella, appears to him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're down there on the ground together. And so he is in between her and the tree. And mm-hmm. and she encourages him to go and climb that tree. And he goes and he climbs up the tree. And that's where he has his final moment. But the interesting thing about that is that image is also in 2001. One of the paintings in the room where David Bowman spends his final days shows a man climbing a tree. And behind him on the ground is a woman. So it's the exact same image.
Interesting.
Just for fans of the film,
right.
He
himself expressed that 2001 A Space Odyssey was one of his main inspirations.
Oh, I didn't know that. It's pretty obvious, yeah. Because of course,
2001 and The Matrix were what he wanted to follow in the vein of.
Wow.
Mm. Well, I think he succeeded, and it's a pity the film isn't more widely watched because it's a beautiful movie.
Well, it's impenetrable to most people, isn't it?
The
average person.
Well, if you don't have a context for what's actually being pointed to, and you don't realize the subtext, it's not quite as entertaining.
I guess. I mean, I was...
people walked out of the theater when I watched that in the theater. I watched it twice in the theater, and both times people walked out.
Yeah, I could imagine that.
Really?
You could see the energy of them walking out. Yeah. People were really I think it was the way that it was advertised. That was why they had this whole marketing issue. They wanted to present it a certain way as this kind of epic thing, and people didn't realize what they were in for. But the deal, like, I was just thinking actually about Black Swan a lot. So Black Swan is pi, completely.
Yes.
The black and the white are the pieces of the Go board, and the spiral that's represented at the end of pi by Sol, which is the sun, Max's teacher, Max Cohen, by the way. There you have one of your Cohen brothers. when they represent that spiral, you can see at the end where Natalie Portman walks up the symbolic pyramid where she dies, where she gets the arrow at the sun, right, where she starts to bleed right at the climax
and
falls to her death. That is what happens with Max. He goes into the center through the name. But the thing was, is like, you know, traditionally this 216 letter name, although this is an entire, that's symbolic because 216 is Gevorah. The value of Gevorah is 216. And it's also a 216 letter name that's produced from the splitting of the waters in Exodus when Moses leads the Israelites, not really Israelites yet, but the multitude through the center between the polarities of the sea, right? And then it crushes the Egyptians. That's 216 letters actually produced from those couple passages, which is really interesting. But just to tie it back, the fact that the lead, the high priest, would go up to the top of the temple to deliver this name to the heavens, basically, to recite it to Adonai. And that was, you know, this whole, he had to be properly prepared and all of this stuff. This is why they say, why they put Max down in the film Pi, is they're expressing that you're not pure. You have to be pure to basically be able to accomplish this feat. It's the same thing where you have, you know, she wants to be perfect in Black Swan, but when she moves to the top of that thing where she starts to bleed at the sun, that's symbolic of the high priest moving to the top of the temple to deliver the name and to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And she's like, it was perfect, but it wasn't perfect in the way one might from the outside. Everyone's judging her or tripping out on her. They don't see the work that she's actually doing. because the work that she's actually doing is her own path. It's her own expression. You can't know it from the outside in. You can only know it from the inside out. There's no way to judge this from any external means. And so you can just, the parallel there is uncanny. Also, at the end of The Wrestler, he puts his arms out in the shape of the crucified Christ, which is grafted to the tree, who is Randy the Ram, which is another RR, Red Rum, Randy the Ram is the sacrificial ram. And at the end where he kills himself, where he surrenders, it's the same fucking thing again. Saul is the son, Max's teacher. He is a sacrifice. But at the moment of death, what does he do? He lays out the black and white go board pieces in a perfect spiral, showing that there is an ultimate equilibrium in the midst of every possible combination of form.
Mm. So I think we all agree that Darren Aronofsky kicks ass, and so I wonder what is he up to next? Yeah. I'm living in a.
I'm with you on that one.
Well, who do you draw a circle on as far as the directors of the last 15 years who are approaching levels that Kubrick set standards for? I mean, Aronofsky seems to be in that pool.
I wouldn't agree with that, honestly. I mean, if we're going to talk movies. I would say that Kubrick didn't set standards. As far as I'm concerned, Kubrick assassinated cinema with Eyes Wide, with Eyes Wide Shut. Eyes Wide Shut is the last movie, in my opinion. That's what it should be called. He created something that is so intensely cinematic. And this is, I enjoyed the Matrix movies very much too. And 1999 as a year was a very interesting year for film. In general, a very interesting year. American Beauty came out that year. I became convinced. These films had a very profound effect on me because I was living a kind of a square existence, basically. I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't party. I just worked and took care of my girlfriend, basically. And I became convinced that the movies of 1999 were trying to get me to smoke marijuana, basically. But there was a message. No, I mean it.
No, like, I believe you're right, because we came out of the heroin movies of the mid-90s.
Yes. But, I mean, the heroin movies are stories of people who destroy their lives. But the marijuana movies of the late 90s culminating very strongly, and I could go on about this, in 1999, those movies promised some kind of transcendent experience.
Absolutely.
And
spent Bill on his whole insane trip. They got stoned. And he dropped her experience on him, and he couldn't cope.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This is I think it's a program thing from some direction. But in regards to what and the reason I single out, this is what I mean by movies now. I mean, because movies, they just doesn't mean what it used to mean anymore. And I don't want to sound like an old man, or I don't want to sound like I'm whining, because I'm not. I do appreciate many things that are being done in cinema, but cinema is now almost more like animation than it ever was cinema, because there's a concept of the camera, basically. And the one really great film that got made this year that is not being talked about at all is The Master, basically. And this movie, this is a piece of cinema.
That's what the movie I was going to get to, but keep going.
But this is a piece of cinema. But the thing of it is that Paul Thompson, he cannot outdo Kubrick. He's just very cleverly, lovingly imitating Kubrick, basically, in The Master, essentially, using scenes right out of Kubrick's movies and just staging them in a different way, basically.
Give me an example.
Okay, well, have you seen The Master, David?
Yeah, I loved it, yeah.
Okay. Well, right near the beginning of the film, there's a scene where the main character played by Joaquin Phoenix reaches up and he cracks open an oil pan where they've been fermenting some liquor on board the ship that he's on. And they pour down and all the men crowd around him and drink it. And they're doing it. While they're doing it, the soundtrack is a radio. And the radio is saying, the war is over, the war is over, right? It's a disembodied voice. That scene is shot and lit and colored in the exact same way as David Bowman entering to dismantle Hal, right? He goes in, he dismantles Hal, and at that point, the voice of Doom comes up. You have been traveling to the. It's a radio talking to him from some distant place.
This is the recorded briefing made prior to your departure, which for security reasons of the highest importance have been known on board during the L9000 computer.
Well, that's what Paul Talon,
the first
he's
evidence
doing that.
Of intelligent life has appeared off the Earth. Yeah, never mind. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. That's the thing. Is that that scene is copied and then it's copied and then pasted right into the master. Basically, there's a couple of other ones as well. The scene in the he pairs the idea of Joaquin Phoenix with Nick Nightingale, with the character Nick Nightingale, in the scene in the shopping center where he works as a photographer. Actually,
test is with Clockwork Orange, right?
Yes. Yeah. You're getting the point. He's just, and this is what I mean about cinema, is the concept of the camera, basically. And we are no longer living in a world in which the camera has a position.
Oh, I love it. I didn't even catch that. The significance of that, of him as a photographer in the
show,
and that he is like the director who's having to put up with. Oh, yeah. Okay. I dig it.